From WXXI News, this is Connections. Evan Dawson has the week off. I'm Scott Feibusch. Our connection this hour is being made literally all over the place, maybe right even this very second. Here in the city that gave birth to the idea of snapshot photography, we are taking more pictures than ever. Whether it's a sidewalk selfie, a carefully filtered celebration of the sandwich you're about to eat, a pretty sunset, or a picture of the studio where you're about to sit down and be a guest on a radio show, our smartphones now give us the power to capture images of everything around us all the time. But with that great power, what kind of responsibility do we have about how and when we use it? And how do we make the most of those tiny cameras? We will be shining light on this topic from several angles this hour with our guests. Ricky Figueroa is an associate professor at RIT's School of Film and Animation. Russ Lund is a professional photographer and digital media specialist, and also a former colleague of mine back in our Time Warner cable days years ago. And Steve Carter and Justin Doucette are the creative minds who have helped make the Explore Rochester hashtag on Instagram into a big part of this city's visual landscape. You can connect with us, as always, orally at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or on Twitter at Scott Feibusch. Or connect with us visually this hour, too. Use the hashtag the hashtag WXXI Connections, and we'll look for your visual comments on Instagram this hour as well. Thank you, everyone, for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Let's start with this question that kind of got this all started. I put out a call on social media last week saying, hey, I'm hosting this show. What kind of topics could we talk about? And Russ chimed in right away, and he said, you know, that a lot of people are talking about this idea that, you know, you go to a wedding, what are the rules now? It used to be you had one professional photographer maybe at the back of the hall, and if you're lucky, maybe it was that era where you had the disposable film cameras on the tables for your guests to take some pictures, and that was about all the visual record that you had. Now everybody's got a phone. When, how, why should and shouldn't you be using it? I'll start with you, Russ, because you started all this.
Well, I think that it also goes back to even the days of VHS camcorders at kids' school plays. You'd have like a whole bunch of people standing up in the front. And what we did back then was we'd say, okay, let's just have one person record the play rather than 40. And that was the solution back then. But today, people feel it's their right or it's their, you know, They're the only ones there with a camera or a smartphone camera. And I think that what I've tried to do is I'm talking to some a bride and groom that in July we will be doing a kind of experiment where I assign the different people in the wedding party tasks, or I assign the groom to certain people and I assign the bride to other people, so that not everybody is standing around one person in photographing. And then we're going to take the material and then assemble that into a finished product, and hopefully they're not all standing up at the same time and at the church.
Okay, Ricky, this is something you think about on an academic level. Take this to a broader picture. Kind of give us a historical sense, even beyond what Russ is talking about with VHS camcorders. How did we get to this point?
Well, I think that accessibility, and I think that people also today are thinking always of how can they document their lives, right? You know, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, all of these apps allow people to constantly, you know, be updating what is it that they're doing. That's basically how all of these apps have become famous. So I think that that has a lot to do in terms of how people feel when they attend any event. I think that doesn't only happen at weddings, right? But maybe you have all been at a concert. You know, you go to concerts, and I've actually seen the act at the concert stop the concert, mm-hmm. and ask people, please, you know, enjoy the concert, put your phones away. So I think it's just, I don't think people try to be rude. I don't think people, it's just that we are in this mode now where we feel like we want to document every single moment, like every experience, every unique experience, and weddings are definitely something that are part of that. And just the ease of use of the technology kind of like allows people to do that. Not only having, you know, very good cameras in cell phones, but also having very good software that allows people to create some really interesting images right in, you know, 5-10 seconds, and upload those and see who gets most likes, right?
Which brings us around to the Instagram side of the table here, and to Steve and Justin. I mean, this is what you guys do. You document visually, and you do a great job doing it, and you've brought together a great community of people who do a great job doing it. Talk to me about being in your generation, about growing up with this, essentially.
Yeah, for me, I was not interested in photography until social media came around. Instagram, when it came out, like it was 2012, that's when I first like started using my phone for photography. Before that, it was just kind of a hobby for selfies and whatnot. I don't really take selfies. yeah, and so as that grew, my interest grew with it. Seeing other people, the kind of images they're able to create with a camera, and as the technology grew, you kind of learn with it, the apps that come out, the different software allows you to learn and grow. And so I think it's a big part of like my interest personally in photography. And I know with a bunch of other people that weren't interested in photography early on, as social media became a big part of it, sharing on Twitter, sharing on Instagram, you share more. And so that's what really, like with hashtags, that's really what brought our community out.
Right. Yeah. So like, not only do we always have the ability to take pictures, we have a constant stream of people inspiring us. Mm-hmm. So you took an awesome picture yesterday and you were really proud of it. And then you scroll through Twitter or scroll through Instagram and you see an hour later, somebody took an awesome picture and you're like, I got to top that. Like, I know I can take a better photo than that. So yeah, maybe it's a little bit of internal competition that we're all going through, but we always have the ability to expand on an idea or expand on a photo that we took earlier, and it's so easy to do that.
Which is a whole different dynamic. I mean, I grew up, and I'm guessing Russ and Ricky, you guys probably did too. I grew up in my high school darkroom, you know, and I spent a lot of time in there inhaling who knows what kind of fumes from developer and fixer, and, you know, if you were lucky, by the end of the day, you might have had one or two good shots that you could tack up on the bulletin board and share with 20 or 30 people. And now you were just in San Francisco, Steve, and I saw some of your pictures from there. I was there in December, and you want to show everybody, hey, look, I'm here, and I can share it with you right now.
Yeah.
And show you what I'm doing. I mean, it's amazing to me to think of how easy that is.
Yeah. The process, I mean, yeah, you take the photo, and then within minutes, you can have it shared to hundreds, thousands of people. That process has become so much easier. And I mean, even with like, within Instagram, you could just throw a filter on it. But like, if you decide to go through like a bigger processing route, you could throw it up through VSCO or into, they have so many different ones. There's Afterlight, Snapseed. You can name so many, Prime. Yeah. So
there must be like somebody making up all these names. I don't know all. I feel like I'm like the grandpa photography guy here. When I started in the darkroom back in the day, you know, it was, you know, chemicals, this and that, and I developed the picture, and I go, look, it only took me a half hour to make this picture. And then the Polaroid, you know, oh, man, 60 seconds. Look at how fast that is. Then I got hold of a video camera, like 1979, and you click it, and you push the button, and the thing goes around, and you can play it back right away. You don't have to wait 1 minute. And that was exciting, you know. Back when I was a kid, we had 3.5 minutes on an 8mm film. And it cost you about $40, whatever, back then. And you didn't get pictures of people loading the car. Mm-hmm. You know, you just got the trip, 3.5 minutes. You didn't get an hour and a half. I have kind of like a pet peeve about all the things you can add on and stuff. Didn't we try to get rid of lens flare? You know, where they add those filters in. Didn't they have
now
scientists?
Apps just for
they
that.
Have scientists. And then what about the fogged film effect? Why would you use that? I mean, it's like... So I guess I am like, in my day, you know. Anyway.
You should have seen the 400-speed film we had that didn't have grain in it. It was amazing.
The shadow detail wasn't really there, but yeah.
It absolutely was. We want to bring you in on our conversation about having this ubiquitous photography available to you everywhere. 844-295-TALK is our phone number. Twitter, at Scott Feibusch. And if you're on Instagram, hashtag WXXI Connections, and we can get some visual aspects into this conversation as well. We've had some feedback online already today about what should some of these rules be at events. And a couple of people have pointed out generally at Catholic churches, for instance, you know, the rule is you do not take pictures during the ceremony when it's going on. It's the same thing. I was just at a family bar mitzvah a couple of weeks ago. Same rule there. The phones go away. There is one professional photographer sort of behind a brick screen on the side shooting a few pictures, and that was that. Stuart on Twitter suggests it's fine to use cameras, but not right in front of the paid photographers. You've done professional photography at these kind of events, especially you, Russ. What kind of rules do you like to lay down if you even have the ability to do it?
Well, initially when you're shooting the formal portraits after the ceremony, which is probably the most important part for the memories, because that's when everyone goes, oh, she was wearing this, and look at how they're, you know, this and that. And it's the pictures where you get everyone in first, and then you take the big picture, and then you whittle it down to just the bride and groom, and everyone goes to the reception. That's the time you say, you can't come in and take pictures until I say so. And then you take the big picture, and then you let them an onslaught come in and take their snaps, because I don't want people to feel like they can't. So that's the only real rules that I ever had with basically the formal pictures. But I think that because it's permeated so much now, that there has to be some way to, I don't even know how to do it. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking this idea of assigning people different, like family members, so they know them, and then if there's an interaction, it's honest. You know what I mean? If there's a way to do that and have them sort of feel like I'm mostly thinking video at this point, the groom and his best buddy, it's your job to get his intimate moment before the wedding, you know, or it's your job to get the bride just before the wedding, and I'm not there being this photog guy in the way. And then everybody's assigned, or, you know, like there's a second unit, you know, and the first unit. And we have a remote camera.
You're over there getting B-roll.
We have a remote camera that we usually put in the balcony if we can, and that's both video and, because it's a DSLR with, you know. But having people with an arsenal of cameras is just awesome.
It's more natural that way, I think.
Is there a change generationally in how self-conscious people are? I mean, I know I'm aware, being in my generation, oh yeah, somebody's over there shooting this, I should probably be on my best behavior or whatever. And I think I look at my kids' generation, and they're just so accustomed that somebody's always shooting something somewhere around them that it's not a thing to them. Am I right in perceiving a generational difference there?
Well, I think my kids are 22 and 19, so, you know, they are definitely in this generation and I find it that, yeah, absolutely. And it's very natural for them to just document everything. It's very, you know, very normal. And, you know, not only from a snapshot point of view, but I find that it's very interesting that they become 7 seconds, is it, for Snapchat or something like that? Or now it's 15, 10 seconds?
Seconds, yeah.
So they become 10-second, you know, directors. Because you'll see them, like, editing and putting this together and putting that together. So, which I find it to be a very interesting thing. And I think going back to one of the comments made earlier, I think that everybody is creative. You know, there's a certain sense of being creative, and that drives that competition that we were talking a little bit about before, and having those tools just feeds that. It's like, I know I can make a mini movie or a shot that will look, you know, fantastic.
Yeah. It amazes me, and I know I'm dating myself here, but my daughter is in sixth grade, and she and her Girl Scout troop are making a movie right now, and I was helping them the other day. I loaned them my DSLR and got them set up with some audio equipment and everything. And I look, and one of the girls is over there as we're doing the shot, and she's got her iPhone out. And I looked, and sure enough, she's getting a second angle on the shot. And nobody asked to. It's one of those things that comes so naturally.
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated to see what that kind of vocabulary is going to produce as we go forward. What kind of age group? Well, we'll get back over here to Steve and Justin. What kind of age group, within your Explore Rochester group, and you've got, 60? You got 60,000 followers right now on Instagram, Steve, and I know you got a big pile, Justin. Of the people who are really actively participating in Explore Rochester, any idea demographically what kind of age groups you have there? Does it lean younger?
I think it does. I think it does lean younger, just because those are the people that happen to be on Instagram and use it the most. But it expands beyond that. I know we have a lot of people that are older generations that are starting to pick up and use Instagram, and sometimes just for the consumption aspect, to see like their kids that are on it, but sometimes as well like joining in. And a lot of them, we're trying to like get more and more people involved, spread out the demographic on Explore Rochester. Right now it just tends to be a lot of younger millennials that are using it.
I agree with what Steve said. Yeah. I've seen a lot of interaction. A lot of the interaction amongst our page is taking place between the younger generation and an older generation. So that's pretty cool to see, because they are talking to each other through that. And Yeah, I would say it's mostly younger.
And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to, like, facilitate a community online through that and offline.
Yeah.
But with that, connecting different generations, different demographics. So it's really, Explore Rochester is open to everyone. We just, it just tends to be a younger generation that's on it right now.
You had over the winter, there was a meetup that you guys did that our reporter, Veronica Volk,
yeah,
went out and covered and participated in, was very excited about getting you guys in here today to, yeah, to be part of the conversation. Are there going to be more of these in-person,
yeah,
gatherings?
Possibly announcing one as soon as this Saturday. Okay. Another one coming up within the next two, three weeks. Yeah. So
I think that, very interesting, because I think that younger generations are naturally, you know, exposed and know how to interact with Instagram and, mm-hmm, and it's part of their daily lives. But one thing that I found too with the older generations, you know, like myself, is that if you have a specific hobby, I have friends who are, you know, into cooking, or I'm a amateur triathlete, and I have, so they'll use a lot Instagram, Twitter, all of these social media outlets to document that hobby, yeah, that, oh, yeah, they do. And I think that's kind of like what brings them into using the you know, Instagram or something. It's like, I have a friend who posts every day some recipe on Facebook, and she's about my age, but that's, you know, big for her. And that's kind of like what drives her and takes photographs and everything. So I think that for the older generations, it's tying it into their hobby or their, you know, their job or something that they can document.
Right, and it's allowing you to connect with other people that are documenting it as their hobby, and you know, you create a world of people online that they might be across the country, but you're able to share recipes with them. You're able to take pictures at your triathlon and be like, "Oh, I was at this one over the weekend. You were at that one. How was it?"
So funny. This past weekend, I was training up in Lake Placid. A friend tagged me on a saying, hopefully, you know, I'll be there in July." I have this friend who is there now. And we met through Instagram, and, yeah, and her comment was like, "It's so funny. My friends were laughing that we met through Instagram." Yeah. And it's like, and that was all. But it happens a lot.
But if you share that common interest, absolutely. I will tell you a personal story and expose my utter geekiness at the same time. I, for years, have had a hobby where I take pictures of broadcast facilities, and for a long time, it was just this kind of weird hobby that I mostly kept to myself, and eventually put up on a web page. And all of a sudden, a few years ago, this Facebook group started up. I take pictures of transmitter sites. There are 7,000 people taking part in this group now. And you would never have imagined that there are that many people. A lot of them are engineers who are saying, "Hey, look where I'm working today." There are people helping each other solve problems on there. Gee, take a look at the capacitor and this transmitter. Where can I get a replacement for it? And honestly, there, you know, people get answers faster than they get anywhere else that way and help each other solve problems. But I never would have dreamed there were 7,000 people who would find something like that. And there are groups like that all over the place. It is absolutely a remarkable thing. Some input from several professional photographers on Facebook. Kevin in Denver says, "I can't recall being at a wedding where folks didn't pull out a camera to snap a photo or two during the ceremony, and this goes way back to the days of film. Yes, the wedding party hires their own photographer, but those photos are for them. The guests would like to remember the event as well," which I think is absolutely true.
Interesting thing off that, too. Like, at least every wedding that I've been to, the bride and groom encourage people through like a hashtag because of social media. Mm-hmm. And so it is for the people documenting it for themselves too, but it's also for the bride and groom because the bride and groom can go back and see all these different perspectives of people sharing their wedding. And so I think, and they're encouraging that. You see signs all throughout it in the brochure, everything. So
make sure you use the hashtag.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not,
and it's always creative.
I'm not necessarily against the idea of, people in the audience or people in the bridal party, mm-hmm, from photographing. What I try to do is I try to coach them ahead of time. Mm. You know, don't just stand there. Crouch down. Get a different angle. Hold your breath when you're taking a still picture. Use your camera like it's creating an image in your mind rather than just sucking up the world. Mm. And then I hate that when I see someone just going like this. Might as well use a security camera. But if you can take a picture that is different, and I think that just as kids learn how to video edit all these years by watching television, because it's built into you, we're starting to be more sophisticated photographers from watching all the other people's photos. You're sitting there looking at theirs, and you're trained visually. And I think it's just cool the way the technology has advanced.
I was at Niagara Falls a few weeks ago, and you know, a lot of people were just holding up the camera, like, "Okay, I know what the falls look like. There are 7 zillion better pictures of the falls out there than anybody can take. I want to see what the people who I'm with are doing and how they're reacting." And And that here's sort of an opposing view from Peter in Syracuse, who DJs at weddings. He says guests might think they're doing a couple a favor, but they're actually ruining the shots for the professional who's often getting paid $1,000 or more to get those important shots. He says some couples now stay clearly in the invitation. They don't want anybody else taking pictures, and I'd imagine there are many more who wish they had thought of it. And there was, we were talking about this in the newsroom the other day, and there was definitely sort of a divide there.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was just at a wedding this weekend, and they had a hashtag, and they encouraged people to take photos, even during the ceremony. I mean, I saw people, like, even older generations using their phones, but they were holding it close to them, and, it wasn't like anybody running into the aisle to take the photo. They still respected the photographer's angles and everything like that. And
so there's some self-restraint.
Yeah.
And that's a courtesy. That's right. A politeness. I think that maybe the younger age people are just like, get it in your face.
Well, I was at a wedding about a year ago, and just getting into the church, the wedding planner was actually talking to everybody that was going into the church and asking to please restrain from taking pictures during a certain period of time. And then the wedding planner went and said, okay, now if you want to take pictures now, anybody, you can take pictures. And it was very smooth, very nicely done. The professional photographer was taking pictures during the time that it was, and everybody respected it, actually. So I think it's a combination of having a good conversation with the guests and letting them know that, you know, there's a certain moment for the professional photographer to get the shots that he's or she are being paid for. And there's a time to then, you know, go crazy, you know, for the guests and the friends to take everything.
And there were several suggestions on Facebook. Somebody was at a wedding where the next thing the officiant said after I now pronounce you husband and wife was, you may now update your Facebook status and take a selfie. And they did. And that's, you know, if that's what you want to do, that's what you want to do. And if that's where things are going, I imagine at the same time, you've got a lot of people walking around, with gray hair saying, what's a hashtag again? What does that mean?
But perhaps if they have a program or an event rundown of the wedding, they could have an asterisk or something. Okay. Like the old days of, standing up and sitting down here for this song, or I don't know, just, or maybe a sign like on the golf course. Quiet, please. Photos, please.
Photos, okay.
Yeah. iPhones now.
Which in some ways, you know, I know like a lot of the Jewish ceremonies that I go to for people who are coming to the ceremony who aren't Jewish, there's a little book that says, okay, here's what we do here, here's what we do there, here's what's allowed, here's what's not allowed. You know, please put on a yarmulke and don't take pictures right now. Fine. If that works. 844-295-TALK is our phone number here on Connections. Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. We are talking about cell phones and photography and Instagram. We're going to get some tips coming up in the next part of the show about how to make your images better. And we want to get your questions as well. You can also go on Twitter. I'm at Scott Feibusch. I'm at Feibusch on Instagram, and use the hashtag WXXI Connections. Looking forward to hearing from you as we continue here on member-supported public radio, AM 1370, FM 88.5 in Rochester, 89.5 in the Finger Lakes, online at WXXI.org. Coming up in our second hour, we unlock a door to another dimension, a dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind, or at least into the mind of the creator of that famous Twilight Zone introduction, as we talk with Amy Boyle Johnston. She's the author of a new book about Rod Serling and what else he was doing when he wasn't in the Twilight Zone. Join our conversation just ahead in the next hour of Connections.
In the Florida Panhandle, a man named M.C. Davis has turned his fortune to conservation, buying up land and restoring it. But he wasn't always a tree hugger.
I was somewhere to the right of Attila the Hun.
His journey from hardcore capitalist to committed conservationist, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
It's Connections on member-supported public radio. We have a room full of people taking pictures of each other and putting them up on Instagram and tweeting them and on Facebook. We are talking about cell phone photography, about how to make the most of it, where it's appropriate, where it might not be appropriate, and we want to talk with you. 844-295-TALK. You can also use Twitter, at Scott Feibusch this week, and on Instagram, hashtag WXXI Connections. Veronica in the newsroom just tweeted a photo that I'm glad she didn't take herself. showing somebody's legs hanging out over the edge of what looks like a building. I'm not sure if that's Times Square or somewhere. I guess that's Times Square there. She says, as portable as cameras have become, how does that influence where and when you can take a picture? And, of course, I'm looking at that, and I'm thinking about the history of photography courses that I took, and I'm thinking of all those pictures of the workers eating lunch out on the steel frames of New York skyscrapers nearly a century ago. So this is not anything new, but, you know, when should you just turn the camera off? One question on Facebook said, come on, funerals, really?
No.
Russ is
shaking his head now.
I don't do funerals. I actually almost quit a job at a photo lab over that. Somebody wanted a photograph of somebody.
Culturally, though, there's a long history in some cultures of...
Usually that was the only photograph.
Yeah.
They would have one when they were, you know, born or whatever, but then the photograph when they were dead was the, you know, the only picture. It's weird. I think that the angle or the how things can be improved in a photograph is just, you know, as simple as standing on a chair or, like, I put my phone on the railroad tracks. And, you know, I just think that try not to bring attention to the camera. Don't use the digital zoom. Don't move it if you don't need to. You know, just let things happen in front of it. That's kind of like the old documentary style. I don't know about you guys. What do you? Everyone's always swishing the camera around, and then.
Yeah, I think back to Veronica's question, what she said. I think part of it is like personal preference and just making sure you don't overdo it. Like sometimes, I mean, people. Where did I see it? It was the Vatican when the Pope was sworn in, and you just see like a swarm of people with like photos, and they're not like paying attention to what's actually happened. They're more worried about taking the photo of it. And same with like concerts, you see that too. And sometimes it's good to just put that away and take in the moment.
Mm-hmm. When are your moments? When do you turn your phone off and just sit there and say, I'm just going to be here right now in this? And I don't need a picture of it.
Usually when the battery's dead.
Honest answer, yes.
I think I've learned through the years, right? Because I think it's been selfies have become more and more, not selfies, but photographs and having the cell phones in at these events, right? I try to go by the rule that if it starts interfering with my ability to enjoy that moment,
right.
Is it if it's a concert, if it's just looking at the Grand Canyon or a theme park or whatever it is, right? It's like, of course, there's always going to be like, you got to take one picture, right, or something.
Right.
But there's a moment to take it away, and for example, at concerts, I try to just take a picture at the beginning. Hey, I'm at this concert, and then I put it away.
Right.
I don't take any more pictures unless I'm lucky to go backstage or something, and then you meet somebody. But during the concert, I just try to enjoy it.
I think we just try and think about, you know, how is this photo going to contribute to what we're experiencing and not take away from it. So it's just a matter of, we've always have it on us, and it's rarely dead because we bring extra chargers. So we just think, you know, it's a way until you see something that you want to capture and then take it out. But other than that, you know, live right then and then capture what can contribute rather than take away from it by trying to capture.
And the nice thing about smartphone too is since it's so convenient and small, you could take it out, take a photo, put it away within 10 seconds.
Yeah.
Like you could get all that done and then enjoy the moment. So, I mean, at a concert.
So yeah. You're making the case you can do both.
Yeah.
You can,
yes.
But I don't always recommend it.
But a lot of
personal.
People don't.
Yeah. yeah.
So following on that, there was an article in a recent issue of The New Yorker about Lewis Carroll, wrote Alice in Wonderland. And he was about as avid an amateur photographer as existed in his day at the end of the 19th century. And the article noted that over the course of his lifetime, he took an absolutely amazing 3,100 photographs, which, you know, when you're doing them on glass plates, that was a lot of pictures to take. I would expect you guys probably take 3,100 pictures in a week or a month. I know I'll go on trips and come back with a couple thousand pictures. When do you go back and revisit them? When you've got that many images of things that you've done, what do you go back and look at?
Currently on my phone, I have 4,553 photos. I'm probably not going to revisit most of those and probably going to delete a lot of them. But where I find myself going back and revisiting, like on social media, like through Instagram has become a photo, personal photo journal to document travels and experiences and things with friends. And so being able to go back there, it just so happens to be social in the fact that other people can see what I'm doing too, but it's really cool to be able to go back and see something from a year or two ago and be like, oh, I
absolutely.
This.
I think that Instagram, Facebook, all of them have just become today's photo albums, right? Yeah. You had a shoebox at our time with the photos that didn't make it to the photo album, right? They're there somewhere, right? In the memory of the phone or in the cloud somewhere. But what makes it to the photo albums are the ones that we decide to upload, right? And those do actually document, you know, that last year or whatever.
And hopefully they are the better quality images too. So the highlights, I guess.
Usually, yeah, when you upload something, it's like you've looked at it, you've cropped it, maybe you picked out of a different exposures. I know that for me, I always had a camera with me, but I didn't have a phone camera. And the phone camera lets me take a lot more pictures because it's not, you have to pull it out and do this and that. Next thing you know, you have a picture. I have like almost 9,000 pictures or something in the last couple of years. And it's like because of the fact that it's convenient and accessible and it does a great job in low light. I do time exposures at night and I just, you know, I prop myself against the car and it's just like it can see better than I can. It can suck light out of the shadows.
I want to get some of our callers in here at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Abe in Brighton, you're on Connections. Hi.
Hello, is that me?
It's you.
Good, thank you. We all use photography to communicate. And before the days of digital photography, we communicated verbally. And anyone who's tried to write a technical paper realizes how difficult it is to communicate verbally. But we also know that a picture is worth 1,000 words. And with the disciplined use of photography, videography, or movie making, we can tell a really good story in a much more efficient way than ever before. I wonder at what point videography, movie skills, and photo skills like this will become a part of our school curriculum for kids to learn how to communicate with a combination of verbal skills and photographic skills.
That is an excellent question, Russ. You've got an answer to that.
I spent over 6 years at the Pittsburgh Central Schools as the audiovisual supervisor, and every year I would go to the cable commission and say, I want 0.5% for a camera. And I said, the number one way we communicate today is with video and TV, movies, and we're not teaching it. And they would go, sit down, Mr. Lund. No. But it's like, yes, why aren't we teaching the way to communicate in our schools? It's a vocabulary. And I just, I mean, some schools have tech programs, but that's just, it's sad, I think.
Are you finding, Ricky, that the students who are coming to you at this point now, having done this through most of their lives, are they coming with that vocabulary, even if they didn't necessarily get it as formal education in school?
So it's very interesting because, yes, we do. We do. We have students that come and understand a little bit better than before, kind of like what entails to actually put a movie together or an animation together. But nevertheless, as they quickly find that there's a lot to learn in terms of being able to do it at a professional level and at a high level. And they think that, yeah, we have all these tools and it's very easy to capture the images. It's very hard to put those images together and put them together in a way that they tell a story effectively and they also look how they're supposed to look when we look at them in the movie theater or at our home television. So it's a little bit of both. You know, the language is there, the knowledge is there, at least at a very basic level. Once they get to our programs, then they realize, well, there's a lot to learn.
And there absolutely is. As Russ can testify, having had to live with me through this, when I came out of radio and started doing TV here in Rochester, I knew how to do a radio story, but learning all those visual elements and being able to put together a TV story is a whole different thing. And I suspect our producer, Caitlin, who's going to be at RIT next year, and hopefully we'll get to take some classes with you, Ricky. And she's already been doing this stuff. She's been taking a class that Evan's teaching over at Nazareth. And it does seem to me like there's some extent that people are picking this up now a lot earlier.
And it's
becoming part of it. And it's easier to do, of course. You can do it now with your camera and a laptop.
And students that have actually had exposure before, right, either through internships or in high school, definitely can come better prepared. That's absolutely true.
And I think the younger generation tends to be more like early adopters on things. And so when there's a new social media platform like Snapchat or Instagram, they're ones to get on it and try it, see how their friends do it, and adjust based on that. So that gets them that base level of knowledge of like the understanding and then just the refining it over time through education and whatnot. I think.
Right. So a lot of us are like, we're learning by doing, mm-hmm. but everything that we're doing is becoming public immediately. Whereas if you're in school and you're working on a project, a lot of that is going to stay private until you decide mm-hmm. this is good enough to share.
Yeah.
But in that moment, everything's good enough to share. And a lot of it goes up. And then, you know, looking back, it's like, hey, maybe that one doesn't belong in this feed, you know, curating what you're sharing.
Now, I one thing that I find really interesting as an educator is that, you know, we are teaching our students, you know, the technical side of movie making and how to put a story together. But what I find really interesting is that these new technologies also bring new unforeseen ways of telling stories or of communicating with others. So at the same time that we have a formal, you know, and we formalize this, the education and all that, we're also revisiting our curriculums and kind of like looking at how is it that the new technologies are bringing new ways into how we tell stories, how we share information and all that.
And we are so fortunate in this community to have that resource at RIT. I could probably do a show every day just with RIT people. I'm not kidding with the amount of interesting topics that are going on over there. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. If you want to get in on the conversation, I wouldn't wait too much longer. We've only got about 15 minutes left with our panel today. Ricky Figueroa from RIT, professional photographer, digital media specialist Russ Lunn, and Steve Carter and Justin Doucette of Instagram fame. Dan and Henrietta, among other things. Dan and Henrietta, you're next on Connections. Hi, Dan.
Hi. My comment was I'm an installation technician, and we use our cameras all the time, both for doing site visits ahead of time so we can review later, taking pictures of finished jobs, but also during a job, if there's something you don't have access to where you can look at it necessarily, you can kind of stick your hand in there with your mm-hmm. camera and take a picture, you know, inside a wall, inside a ceiling, or behind something you can't necessarily get behind where you can't normally see it. So that's one thing that with the new smartphones and everything that are so ubiquitous, it's really made my job a lot easier in a lot of ways.
I imagine that could also be a good application for the oft-maligned selfie stick.
Yeah.
Which we amazingly haven't talked about yet this hour.
I try not to.
And yeah. But yeah, definitely. I remember I had a flat-screen TV that was mounted on a wall that I had to return. I had to get the serial number off of it. I'm thinking, how can I do this without taking it off the wall? Uh-huh. Take my phone, stick it up back there. And there were about 17 really blurry shots of trying to figure out where the number was back there. But eventually I found it, sent the picture off, and away we went. So thanks for the comment. I appreciate it. Selfie sticks. We're getting a lot of negative looks around the table. Is there a value? Is there a purpose? Is there any reason why you'd want to be caught dead with one?
It's just fun sometimes, mm-hmm. I guess, for this generation at least, and maybe others. I don't know the utility of it necessarily. I mean, maybe you can get it if you have to see something that you couldn't see otherwise, but no.
I made one out of a 48-inch breaker bar, and it had really nice weight to it, so it was sort of like a Steadicam.
There you go.
But and I've also manufactured cases for my cameras out of the reversing a OtterBox with 1/4-20 screws, and a lot of fun. But I don't like the selfie sticks, and I understand they're banning them, like in Europe at the Coliseum. And
a lot of museums places, are concerned about people banging into stuff with them.
And just it's just
imagine
why?
You with your breaker bar stick, you could have done
well,
some damage.
Well, that's outdoors. Yeah. It's for doing automotive videos.
I think that one thing that we haven't also touched on, and you mentioned the Coliseum, and is that the accessibility, you know, of all these photographs online. Right, it's like you visit a certain place and you uploaded that picture, and that picture is going up in many cases not only with pixel information, right, but also geolocation, where was it taken and everything. So, and it's very important. A lot of people, well, today we can do a tour of whatever park we want just with pictures of other people, right? Yeah. And they pinpoint exactly where that photograph was taken. So I think that's also a big part of how the technology kind of like is affecting us.
Yeah, like with Explore Rochester, a lot of us, every person that submits photos, we have them make sure that they geotag it.
Mm-hmm.
So then we're able to tag that location. So if somebody sees this photo amongst the feed, they're like, I really like that place. You can click on there and then you see the map of it, and you can pull that right into your maps on your phone and get directions there and be there within a half hour, from a photo. Whereas, let's even 10 years ago, if you were looking up, you'd be like, where is that? And you'd have to like call them and be like, hey, where'd you take this picture?
People still ask that, though, on Instagram.
I know. They're learning.
Well, it exposes you to parts of the city. I mean, we're sitting here right by High Falls a block away from us. When I was a kid growing up, I never knew that was there.
That's one of the inspirations why I like started Explore Rochester in the first place was I remember posting a photo of High Falls 3-something years ago, and somebody commented, and they had lived here all their life, and they didn't know that that was in Rochester. And I'm not from Rochester, and so seeing that, I was just like, oh my gosh, there's so much here. So, yeah.
Want to get some tips in there, Russ. You've got a list that you've put together of some of your favorite tips that you give to people for how to get the most use out of your phone.
Some of the tips are specific to cell phones or what are they called? Smartphones? but that is to not take it off of the regular lens. Don't use the digital zoom because it usually interferes with the quality. And then whenever you see the camera and not the subject, like when you move the camera or you zoom in and out, you do the trombone thing, you're just looking at someone controlling a camera. You're not looking at your subject. And that's kind of a purist.
With the exception of that guy who put the GoPro actually at the end of his trombone. And did you ever see that?
That's true. I did not see that. But the other thing is,
check it out. It's worth
even, we don't think about sound too much when we're doing videos, but if you have a hum in the background, like a refrigerator or something, unplug it while you're interviewing the person, but make sure you plug it back in. Because these fluorescent lights will buzz. Make sure those are off. The other thing is, a tip that I always give people is to change your angle of view. I've said this before. Get close. When in doubt, get close. That's the simplest rule. The other one is to either stand up or move, you know, to a different angle that you wouldn't normally use. And then just crouch and hold the camera still, because if you're moving it and it's lower light, you're going to not get the sharpest pictures. Even though the technology is there now to get sharp pictures at lower light. One of the other things that I always try to remind people to do is to, bring backup batteries and watch the front of the lens. If it's smudged, you know, with lipstick or whatever the person has on it, you're just not going to get good pictures. So basic stuff.
You guys do a lot of this? Justin, Steve, what advice do you give when people say, how do I make my pictures look as good as yours?
I think, well, one thing that I've stuck with, I have like a DSLR too that I use. I'm going to say that in quotes because I tend to use my phone. Well, on Instagram, at least, I use my phone for everything. And I think it goes back to the saying, like, the best camera is the one you have with you. So the convenience. And thankfully, I mean, with Apple, like, I use an iPhone. I have a 5S. I don't have the newest, but it still can shoot great images. And so I think that's, like, a great part. I think lighting, like with the DSLR, lighting plays a big role. The natural light, try to use that to my benefit. And then the great thing about the iPhones is the processing that's built right in. And so that's what can take a normal photo that anybody could take it and make it look like it's a DSLR photo.
Yeah.
And so you can process some of these images and you couldn't tell the difference sometimes. And so I think that's amazing.
Spend a little time processing and not just like throwing a filter on it. Because when you throw that filter on it, it looks forced.
Exactly.
But you can spend some time bringing out light and bringing out the shadows and deepening the contrast.
Yeah,
I
believe the best HDR photographs are ones you can't tell that are HDR.
Right.
There's a guy on television more recently publishing HDR photos, and it looks like just garish. It's just not fun.
It's forced.
It looks heavy duty.
And he even realizes, I don't mind giving his name because he's been sharing his photos so much. John Kutchko over at Channel 8 is a phenomenal photographer.
Yeah, I've been praising him. He's just
and
really
his,
good.
Follow his Facebook feed because he's putting out just phenomenal pictures there day in and day out. And he's been playing a little bit. We should explain for those who are sitting there saying, what the heck is HDR?
Well, I've got high dynamic range photography. And, one of the things, too, is that it's just coming down the pipe is that HDR... photography lenses, I'm sorry, sensors and processing power in the telephones are allowing anybody to come up with really, really nicely exposed images. And coming down the pipe, displays will allow us to actually see way better images than we have been seeing till today.
We should explain. So what's happening is your camera's really taking a series of images at different exposures and then combining them together so that everything in the image is, I mean, you've seen these, you know, High Falls is real popular for that. Yeah. You see a lot of
what I know about HDR is, as far as our eyes can see the shadow detail and the highlight detail because of our brains. It says, okay, that's bright, that's dark, and it constantly adjusts. But the technology can't, so it takes three pictures and converges them in the best of the low lights and the best of the highlights.
Our producer, Caitlin, pointed out that everything, the class that she was taking from Evan in Nazareth, learning how to do TV news, that everything they were doing was done on an iPhone. So we're at the point now, you know, those heavy cameras that Russ used to lug around, and I occasionally used to have to lug around, increasingly are becoming kind
and
of
sticks,
a thing of the past.
Remember
the heavy tripods. Although, having said that, there is still no substitute for a good tripod lot of
or mounts
photography. Yep.
Stability is important, even if it's a small camera. Even more important with a small camera.
Are you listening, my daughter's Girl Scout troop?
Hold your breath.
The other day?
Take the picture.
Exactly, especially as you get older and a little shakier, it really does make a difference. Got a question about sound for you, Russ, or anybody who wants to chime in. Jake and Webster. Hi, Jake.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
Thanks for having me on. It was just mentioned a second ago, like, you know, if you have a background noise, you know, unplug your refrigerator kind of thing. But something I've kind of noticed with video is that you can get really good video out of simple stuff like your iPhone or GoPro or just, you know, basic consumer-friendly, you know, kind of thing. But the sound quality is really going to suffer. And I guess I was kind of wondering, like, what are, like, you know, fairly basic, fairly reasonable-priced things you could do, you know, to get kind of better sound out of your iPad, your iPhone, your GoPro, your basic handheld camcorder kind of thing.
Well, there is one thing to be said for just putting it closer. And what I do is I have a couple of iPhones, and I put one up at the podium, and then I shoot the main shot from back, you know, in the audience. And then you just merge the two timelines. Because then when you're close to the microphone, it sounds a lot better. You don't have the background noise. There are some wireless applications that just use a quarter-inch input, starting at probably $100 to like $1,000 for wireless microphones. But I think you can't fix something that's there. If it's not there to begin with, you're in much better shape with sound. So I always say the basics is to just make sure there's no trains going by, because we don't hear those. We're busy interviewing somebody. We don't know that there's sound back there. But there are, like I said, things to be said for just moving closer and having even an MP3 recorder. Up close.
I was going to say, you can get some very inexpensive, very high-quality digital audio-only recorders.
Put an XLR
like
mic
Zoom
in there.
And Tascam make those. You don't even necessarily, a lot of them have really good internal mics, and they're small.
And you just drop it in the timeline,
get
make
it up
it
close, get the audio
K,
there,
and
exactly.
You're good.
Exactly. Thanks for the call, Jake. Appreciate it. Bud and Chyla, you're on Connections.
Okay, I have something that I think your guests and you are going to be very fascinated with.
Okay, I've only got about a minute or two here.
I worked at Kodak for 40 years and ended up in digital cameras. I retired in 2000, and I started with another guy, a small company, making the best cameras you could at the time, which were VGA resolution. Mm-hmm. We were making those to sell in Walmart and Target and such places. We also had the great idea of making the self-loaded cameras, the film cameras that all came loaded, and trying to sell them with logos on them. And already by that time, there was no interest in it because parents did not want to have to pay photo finishers for kids shooting the sky and their cat looking the other way and stuff like that. Basically, we lost our shirt because we could not keep up with the technology, even then. And 1.3 megapixel cameras came next. Then they started moving to 2 megapixel, 5, and now commonplace they're around 8 to 12 megapixels. And nobody at Kodak predicted that would move that rapidly. And now you're talking about technology, you know, it's amazing.
It is.
It's truly amazing. And I just thought you wanted to know that a small guy could not keep up with it.
Indeed. Okay. I thank you. I thank you for the call, Bud. We are getting right up to the very end of the hour here. Last thoughts on this, last tips to give out to people. Russ, you're doing a series of seminars on cell phonography, as you call
right.
it?
I have a workshop starting in the beginning of July, and basically two-hour workshops. I'm at the Anderson Arts Building, part of a group called Artists Next Door. And you can find out information at russlund.com. It's a great thing because you can learn how to leverage what you have. You know, some people are really good. They can just get better.
Okay, hashtag Explore Rochester. Check out what you guys are doing. You've got potentially a new meetup coming soon.
Yes, yeah. We'll be posting about that shortly from our Instagram page, at Explore Rochester. So.
Excellent. Check Steve that. Carter and Justin Doucette, Russ Lund, and Ricky Figueroa from RIT's School of Film and Animation. Thanks so much for being with us. Thanks
Thank
for being
you.
Part
Thank
of
you.
Our
Thanks.
Conversation.
Thank you,
Scott.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks. We'll dip into the Twilight Zone next hour. I'm Scott Feibusch. This is Connections from member-supported Public Radio.